You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
In a way, need a change from the spiral scene. Another time, another town, another everything. But it's always back to you.
9:06 on a Wednesday. I'm joined by Michael Musselman from Granbury, Texas. Gunner, what's up?
What's going on?
Nothing. Hey, wanted to have you on today, and could you explain the training that our guys go through and explain how the Hilo Dunker works, and can you explain how you have to wear your equipment and all the kind of preparation that goes through something hitting the water?
Yeah, and so actually this was a problem when I was still there. We were trying to get another Hilo Dunker in Camp Pendleton, because there's only, the problem, Mac, with that is there was only one, and it was that 1st Marine Regiment pool. And it was the dunker for everybody on the West Coast. Miramar had one too, but I forget why. It's either small or they can't put the processor. But, hell, we were dunking guys from Barstow. They had to, you know, do it. So,
right.
You know, the problem was throughput, and then it was priority. So you guys, we had all of these priorities levied on us. So we still had the Mews that were leaving the West Coast. And then we were having, some of the guys that were going overseas in real world missions. Those guys were priority. And then, you know, 31st Mew guys, were kind of the lower priority. We got those guys going. And then a lot of it was they were going to go and get it done in Okinawa when they got there. But then again, then you get third meth, who didn't want that because they want full up rounds. You know, you only deploy for what, 6 months. So they can't afford to have units come over there and then continue training for another couple months, and then only get about 4 months out of them. So it was a big deal trying to get the Hilo Dunker and trying to get an additional pool. We were trying to get 5th Marines to have one built there, but it came down to money. But the process is, and plus, remember, the Hilo Dunker, so the pool at 1st Marines not only does the Hilo Dunker, it does everything else. So we had BRC, Basic Reconnaissance Course out of SOI. They were using that pool. Swim qualifications, your standard swim, you know, swim quals. And then we had the AAV dunker. So guys that were going to go on AAVs had to get qualified. So that's in the same pool. But it's all the same. So you get in there, you go through a process, and they use the heat bottles, which is just a small bottle of oxygen. And you go in your full gear, and you get in a replica frame of a MV-22, and they drop it in the pool, and they make it roll over, and you get out, and they teach you, you know, to have a reference point you hold on to something so you know where you're at, and then thing flips upside down, and then everybody goes out to emergency exit. You know, and it's a great tool. It's the beginning of it, but, you know, the problems with that were, it was kind of unrealistic. It was a clear pool. It was warm.
Right.
You knew what it was doing. It was a controlled environment. You knew that the thing was going to go into the water. You had safety divers sitting in there. I mean, and you didn't have all your, gear. You didn't have, you know, per se, your body armor, all your magazines, your rifle. You had rubber rifles. And your helmet, you have kind of, what they can do. They had some body armor in there, but not realistic, you know, not what you're actually carrying, because for a lot of reasons, you just can't do that to your equipment all the time. And then, what it needed to do was more repetitive, you know, more times you can do it. A lot of guys, it was just one time and that was it. So, you know, it was just, to me, it was always, we kind of hit just the wave tops. We never really went into it, but you know, they do what they can with what they got. So that really what it came out to.
So how many times, if I'm going to deploy as part of a MU, how I would go there one time and go through that training?
Yeah, one time.
Okay. And so the thing goes into the water, and as Mike said, I would just tell you this from even doing a triathlon, right? Swim, run, bike, right? So you swim in the pool, right? Ocean swimming
right.
is nothing like pool swimming. First
oh,
of all,
God, no.
It's not even, I mean, you stick your head down, you can't see shit, you can't see anything, which is different. And then when you rotate your head to take a breath, you can't do what you do in the pool or else you're going to get a mouthful of salt water. You have to crank your head way around. I'm turning my head way around and to get air because of the swell in the ocean. It's completely different. And so imagine, you know, what you did in the pool with the sun up, you're going to do in the darkness of the ocean, either in day or night, and night being substantially different. So, Mike, walk us through when you do it for real and you have all your equipment. What do you do with your plate carrier? How is that arranged so that you can get out of it? Because I don't. Let me let you comment on this, Mike. The fact that whether it was a controlled landing or an uncontrolled landing into the water, 23 of 26 getting out is pretty incredible.
Pretty
yeah?
damn good.
Yes.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible.
And if it was uncontrolled in the water, it's a fucking miracle, to be honest with you. But talk about how do you wear your gear in the aircraft so that you can shed it? Because you're not talking about a like we used to wear a war belt. You're
right.
Talking about a plate carrier.
Well, you got a harness. You have shoulder harnesses and a lap harness. In an MV-22. So not like back in the day when a 46 or 53, we just had the lap belt, and you just unsnap it and go.
That most guys never even snapped.
Yeah, I mean, I never did.
No, and
play
for,
it off.
For this very reason, like I'm not getting stuck with this thing on me.
But you don't have what you're missing in the Helidunker again is all that equipment, your pack. Everybody else's pack in front of you, sitting on your feet. I mean, there's not a lot of room, you know. So, and when that thing hits the water in the pool, it's a drop of, you know, a couple feet, and it's not really a drop. It's just you stick up a little bit of a slam in the water, fills up, and then it starts to roll, and then it goes underneath, and then, you know, you have a quick release. You have on your shoulder, you have a buckle that holds your shoulder harnesses on, you snap that off, you pull the lanyard on your cummerbund, that takes that off. So then your plate carrier falls off in two pieces, and then you swim out of an opening, and then you inflate your life vest.
So that's
you know that?
In theory how that's in theory how it goes. Is the does the Osprey, does it, do you know anything about it? Does it roll fast? Is it designed to stay afloat? Any idea on any of that?
No, I mean, if it's anything like that, it's going to fall apart quick. I mean, once it hits, it's getting ready to go. But it's going to roll because those nacelles, the propeller, you know, the engine's on the wings. That's the weight. And depending on how it went into the, hit the water, you know, if it lands in the belt, if it lands on its belly and goes in, I'm sure that's a little bit more controlled than if it goes in and clips the wing and then it starts to cartwheel.
Right.
But you got to look at, you know, I'm trying to think. It was a long time ago. The 46 that went down in San Diego, right off the coast,
right.
And that was a bunch of recon Marines, you know, and those guys are, that's all they do is swim. And I don't know if maybe it was force recon. I think it was, you know, so that one, I think 14 guys went in the water and that bird went in sideways, seven, 7 died, 11 lived, you know, out of that. So, you know, and that was an uncontrolled in daylight with rescue boats already, I mean, boats already in the water trailing right behind it. So there was boats right there on it.
Right.
But that, if you watch that video, that 46 hits the water, the blades snap off, and it's, the, when it's, the splash is gone, the bird is gone.
Oh, really?
I mean,
that quick.
Oh, yeah. That, yeah, that video where it comes in, and, you know, I think the pilot, you know, he got blamed because he came in a little fast. He,
right.
And he got that, that left wheel or the right back wheel stuck in that net, that steel netting. It was the rear port engine. And it went, the wheel, it went right into the water. I'm watching the video right now. And it was, as soon as it hit and the water was, it was gone. I mean, it went underwater quick. It didn't do what, you know, you're trained to do.
Right.
And guys were already popping out. And it would save a lot of those guys as they were getting ready to get out anyway. So they probably, some of them were standing up, getting ready to get out.
Right.
You know, because they were going to do this quick insertion on the ship. So, yeah, I can't imagine.
So when you're sitting there, you got a waist belt and you got a shoulder harness on, you got all your gear on. Is your, like, do you have, somebody's told me that you have one of your clips, your shoulder clips is undone, so that you can.
Yeah.
Is that how they teach it or what?
I know that there's different types of techniques and procedures,
right.
You know, that people teach. That could be one of them. I'm not saying that I don't. I mean, I every time I've flown the one over water, I always had my cummerbund undone, and then I don't think I had one of my clips undone because they were right there. I mean, I could easily snap it.
Right.
So
let me read you an email. Hey Mac, is there one egress way, and that is out the back of the Osprey? How do you egress that particular aircraft? Right?
No, there. Well, the ramp, but if that's closed, and in most flights, every flight I have ever been on in an MV-22, they close it.
Right.
So, I'm trying to think. I know there's two, one each window off the side, and then there's the crew chief doors. That's four. But I don't know. I'm trying to look at the body of one. Yeah, so it's got one on each side, a porthole, and then the crew chief doors are up, which are up front. But most of the time, every time I rode in an MV-22, the back ramp was closed. So that was never an option.
Wow. The only time I ever rode on one that wasn't, they had like a tail gunner, and they had, I don't even know what kind of weapon it was. Might have been an M60 or a 50 cal, on this big tripod that was sitting on the back ramp. And,
yeah.
It's like, wow, that's the only time I've ever flown with it open.
Oh, so three, Mac. I'm sorry. Three. Two escape hatches on the port side of the ship, and then one on the right, and then the crew chief door on the right.
Okay. All right, so that would be. I've got another. Go ahead. No, I got another email for you.
But the back ramp. You're right. I mean, so the back ramp in Afghanistan and Iraq had a good door gunner. But when we flew MV-22s from California off to the coast or somewhere else, they always closed the back ramp off.
Got it. Email. One of the things I've grown to enjoy about All Marine Radio is that you guys come on after these things happen and do an awesome job explaining. I listened to Mac's comments about the Osprey, and I didn't really think, though, about 23 of 26 getting out and what an incredible feat that was, no matter whether it was a controlled or uncontrolled entry. My question is this. How do you keep from getting stuck on something in the aircraft? Mike just mentioned packs at your feet, your weapons. There's all kinds of stuff hanging off those packs that you can get caught on. There's your own There's your own gear that you have on. Even buttons get hung up on things at time, we know, from putting our gear on and off. Does Mike have any comments about that? Is that simply luck, as somebody not getting hung up in a hatch on his way out? Mike?
Well, you're okay, so let's see. I went down in a helicopter. It was a control, but it was on landing. It was on land. And it was 46, and we had packs and everything else, but when it hit the ground, you could not tell which way was up or down, man. I mean, there was shit everywhere. It threw everything, and you're right. So you have your pack straps, you have your waist belt, you have weapons with slings on them, you have all this gear thrown around, you have injuries, you know, those types of sustainments were blunt force trauma,
right,
you know, hitting you. So it really comes down to is the pack is pretty streamlined. It's just the weight. So it depends on another one that I wasn't involved in the crash, but I was right next, was in like 88. We were off the coast of California on a 46, and a 46 crashed on the ship, lost all power, and then made it back to the ship, but landed on the side of the ship, and we lost one guy. He fell into the ocean. Everybody else was still in the aircraft. And what was remarkable about that, again, was the fact that it made it back to the ship. But the guys, it landed on its port side, and so all those guys on the port side were buried in everybody's gear. All those packs, all those stuff just rolled on top of them, and they were buried in it. So now you're trying to get out of, you know, your seatbelt, and you're trying to climb, push this gear away, get out. That would even make it more difficult. It's just a lot of it, luck. You know, the guy at the exit knowing what he's doing, everybody knowing, you know, to have that point. And the problem comes into, too, if it's uncontrolled, you don't know it until it's already too late. I mean, you've hit the ground, you've hit the water, and now you got to, you're wrecked. So you got that first impact, you're grabbing something, you're trying to remember the exits, you know, two guys down on my right. If it's daylight, it's not bad. It's nighttime, you know. Now you have, there's some light in there, but not much. You know, so now you're trying to find, you grope your way. That's another thing that they do in the helo dunkers. They put this mask or some goggles on you that are darkened so you can't see very good. And you got to feel your way out. But you got to overcome a lot of, the fear, the panic, that initial trauma, a lot of that stuff going through your mind. And now, you know, don't inflate your vest inside the aircraft, because then you ain't getting out.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of dynamics that you got to overcome right away. And, you know, depending on how cold the water was, you know, that initial shock. I mean, if you've never jumped, if it's in room, you know, whatever the temperature is outside, and you jump into 50-degree water, that initial shock of your body, you got to overcome that. You got to come over any blunt force trauma that you received on the impact. Got to overcome that. You know, then you got to get out of that aircraft. And then, like first said, you just make sure that, depending on if the aircraft hit hard, tore up, now you got pieces of aluminum, you know, got airframe jetting out in different directions. You can get hung up on that. You can get stuck. I mean, there's just a lot of things that you gotta just play out just right for you to get the hell out of that thing.
Another email. When I saw the news, I didn't really give it too much thought in terms of what it takes to egress an aircraft like that. But listening to you two talk right now, good God, it's not a minor miracle that 23 of 26 got out.
It's a
no shit miracle. Listening to Mike talk, just when you bounce all the gear, and suppose the guy that's closest to the doorway. Suppose he panics. Suppose something he's dummy corded to his belt gets hung up on a seat or one of the other 8 million goddamn things that are sticking out in that aircraft. Any of those things plug up and exit, and then guys have to turn and go a different way. How long before people panic?
Well, I mean, shit, put people on a bus. If you put 26 guys on a bus and keep it on the side of the road and then lock the rear entry and then have the front entry the only way and then light the damn thing on fire, people... The thing that's crazy, you got to remember, is when you're taught in the helodunker, is you got to have, you really got to be patient. You got to relax. And, you know, and it's kind of that one at a time. The guy in front of you, he goes first, then the next guy. So you're the fifth guy, sixth guy, and maybe you didn't get a good mouthful of air before you hit, or something, again, caused you to go into panic. Now that fifth or sixth guy is clawing his way to be number one. Yeah, there's all sorts of problems that can, there's 100 different things. This is not the miracle on the Hudson where that's a controlled crash. You know, they knew that they were going to crash. They were prepared for it. They had crew members that were vital in that of keeping people calm as soon as they hit, calming them down that, hey, we're not sinking right now. We got time. You know, people in an orderly fashion went out of that plane and, you know, the miracle of the Hudson, I don't know if called it a miracle. I think it's more of that's just skill of the pilot. A miracle is 23 guys getting out of a MV-22 in full combat gear, you know, in whatever, I forget what time it was, nighttime or whatever.
Yeah, 1600, but, 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
So still some light out, but hitting the water and not being prepared for it, and 23 out of 26 getting out of, you know, at very least 3 holes in a small plane that barely enough to fit a man through. I mean, we're not talking, these are not doors. These are holes that are probably 2 foot by 2 foot. You know, they're smaller than a manhole. So, you know, and calmly and orderly trying to get out of that thing. And I don't know if they had heat bottles. So if each Marine had, you know, the 5 minutes of oxygen, you know, in the bottle, where was that? You know, and again, is that fastened to you? Because if guys have that thing sitting down or if it's not in a place where they can readily grab it, then again, impact, boom, heat bottle's gone, more panic. You got to know where everything's at. You just got to, and that's why, you know, when I was down at the regiment, when we train guys in the pool, and I'd always force my guys, the pool guys that are training us, and to talk to people is to be, don't, this is not a joke, this is not a time to screw around, this is not a time to dick around, and a lot of those classes are taught by civilians, so it's all contractors, right. Former Marines that got out, and now they're all contractors, and that's all they do, is they teach this over and over and over and over again, and it's throughput. So there's not a lot of individual time.
Right.
And every once in a while, yeah, you can get guys through and you can do some more repetitions if you get time, but those guys, you know, it's a government pay thing, so they can only work so many hours. They can't work overtime, which is bullshit.
Right.
You know, I always said, turn the goddamn pool, the fuel dunker over to Marine. And they were always, no, 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 no. I'm like, guys, Marines can operate pretty technological shit. There's not much technological shit that's involved in the helodunker. Now, we bring the contractors on to maintain this thing, but we need instructors to be Marines. Why? Because I can work the Marines day and night, 24/7. You know, if we want to do it at night, get up, do a day one, and then do a night one, I'll wait till nightfall and then bring the battalion back. And now I don't have to pay these civilians overtime or have to work for contractor hours and then write some fucking letter to some idiot in D.C. requesting for an additional 10 hours of helodunker time. I mean, that's the shit that we had to do. We owned it, but we couldn't use it the way we could have. And it drove General Mickelson crazy, it drove Furness crazy, it drove Pete Baumgarten crazy. I'm pretty sure it drove Billy McCullough crazy. You know, and so on and so forth. You know, why are we at the whim of this contractor shit? It needs to go away. Each pool in every containment area, Seventh Marines, because Seventh Marines used to have to drive down from the desert to do helo dunker. Now, try and find berthing for another 500, 900 guys. Okay? Good luck. You know, so that was the biggest problem. It was a logistical nightmare to get people through that thing. And then, shit, it would break, and then what?
Yeah, well,
you know, now you're screwed.
You tell me. And so it's the only one on the West Coast, right?
Yeah. And then you result to a freaking plastic chair on a metal bracket in a pool, and you strap a guy down there, and you pull a lever, and the chair rolls over, and you get one guy in. And that's good training. You know, that's bare basic stuff, but that's the bare basic shit. That's what we're talking about.
That's the better than nothing angle.
Yeah.
Wow.
So my pitch was always give the helo dunker to the Marines and build them in every containment area. Margarita, Mateo, Horno, everywhere. Not just one place and then have everybody cycle through there. Put one up at 7th Marines, help put two up at 7th Marines. Yeah.
Let me read you an email. Mac, first of all, let me second the last caller's email relative to the way you explain. You guys are always respectful and articulate about what your concerns are. You don't second guess, and I really have come to enjoy the way you guys explain stuff, whether it was the F-18 outside of Nashville, the one up at 29 Palms, or the other ones that you attempted to discuss without speculating. I appreciate your professionalism, as I do this morning. My question is this, maybe not so much a question as a comment. I was stunned to hear that you only do helo dunker during the day. I would think, even in a pool, the experience at night would be different and would be a requirement. Why isn't that done? Mike probably
just explained it.
Yeah, Mike just explained
it. Yeah. The contractor hours, they can only work so many hours. So, you know, it's basically a 9-to-5 job. You know, Monday through Friday. Can't work on weekends. And then, to replicate the night, they put these dark sunglass, or taped over, you know, sun dust goggles over your eyes. I'm like, that's stupid. You know, or, hey, why not crank that thing up a couple more feet and have it drop at 12 feet, 20 feet?
Right.
You know, I get it, you know, not a full impact, but just enough to jar the senses to really get you out of that. But, and then, hey, come up with some kind of helo dunker system that is mobile, and you could do it right down there at Del Mar Bay, Boat Basin, and do it in the ocean.
That would be, you know, to me, that's the crawl, walk, run piece of it.
Yeah, run piece would be, I pitched this, was to build a ramp system and have that helo dunker frame sitting up on the land right there by the boat launch. You know what I'm talking about, in Del Mar, where that little boat launch is, right?
Right.
And so have this ramp system built, and then everybody climbs into the helo dunker with all their gear, and then have all the safety shit in there. You can have safety boats and safety divers and everything else in there, and then have a quick hydraulic system where if something panics, because the system in the pool is, if there's a problem, they can lift that helo dunker out of that whole body out of there with all full of water in seconds.
The whole thing.
They just pull straight out. Boom. Yeah.
So
no one's really in jeopardy of getting hurt.
Yeah, so if somebody's stuck or whatnot.
Diver can't get to them.
Right.
They can pull that thing right out of the pool in seconds. So this thing, what my proposal at Jeff Delmar was, this thing's on a ramp up at that higher elevation. Everybody climbs into it, it slides down a ramp, and then slams into the ocean, because that's what it is. You know, it's a controlled environment. It's in the Delmar Boat Basin. And then proceeds to flip over. Shit, do that at night with your gear. That's a pretty scary thing. I would be pretty, you know, helo dunker was always cool to me because I could swim. I could hold my breath for a long time.
Right.
I never really bothered me. But if I saw, if someone had something like that built at Del Mar Boat Basin where the water's murky and it's freezing cold, and I had to put all my gear in and slide down this thing at night, you know, into this water and then get out, holy shit. That would put the fear factor in me, man. It would really scare the living hell out of me. It'd make me think twice and make me kind of concentrate more and pay attention a little more. Because again, the Hilo Dunker in a controlled environment in a chlorinated pool during the daytime with all the other stuff going on there, I mean, you can see forever. It was fun. People that panicked, people that didn't like it, were people that couldn't swim. And yes, and I, you know, people asked me this before, you know, are there Marines in the Marine Corps that can't swim? Yes. Well, how do they get in? I don't know. But there are guys in the Marine Corps that can't swim worth shit. And how are they still there? Because I guess you can't kick a Marine out for being a non-swimmer. We put those guys in the AEVs and helos? We sure do. You know, people are like, well, that's abstinent. Well, you know, you got it. To be a Marine, you got to swim. You think in the Navy you have to swim too, but I've known a lot of Navy guys that couldn't swim worth shit. You know, so this is an opportunity, and hopefully it's the last one that we look at it and then we fix fix the potential problem, or we add more Hilo Dunkers. We give this thing back to the Marine Corps for them to teach, and then we get away from contractors because, again, we're limited on so many hours. We can't pay them overtime. I got it. You pay Marines overtime. It's called being a Marine. You're always on overtime.
Right. Well, no, I mean, the way it works, right, is that the contractors would maintain it, but the Marines would operate it.
Because then everything that I had, because, Mac, there's a lot of free time. And the thing that pissed me off the most is, well, people, there's not enough time to do this, that, and the other.
Bullshit.
Okay, you're right. There's not a lot of time to do a lot of shit. A big shit. The big ticket items. But when you're freaking sitting around twiddling your thumbs trying to figure out something to do, and you got 2 hours to kill before Liberty call, get your platoon to the pool. We're going through the Hilo Dunker about six times. You know, get them over here. Get them this. Get them that. Those are things that if you have the capability in your cantonment area, you could do it. You know? And then empower those lieutenants and those staff sergeants to do that stuff. But, I mean, this is one of the risks that it's a risk that we take as being Marines. I mean, Marine, denotes water somewhere in that work. You're going to be in and around water. You got to take it seriously. You know, water is not forgiving. We haven't figured out how to breathe underwater yet without an apparatus. You know, again, heat bottles. We fought long and hard to get heat bottles in Afghanistan because we had guys in vehicles rolling into the aqueduct system and drowning. And because you couldn't open the door because of the pressure of this big armored door, they couldn't open the door. And then it was too late. But a heat bottle would have given them that time. But then the problem came into, well, if we get heat bottles in here, then you got to have people in here that are certified to actually maintain them. And then, okay.
Then do it.
All right. Then what is the problem? I'm not asking you to canoe to the moon. Because you cannot get in a canoe and go to the moon. That's impossible, boys. Everything else is possible. So you're telling me you can't, there's not one Marine in some air wing unit in some survival gear locker or whatever the hell they're called now that will not take an opportunity to deploy tax-free to Afghanistan and sit in a FOB and get fat and work out. And all his job is to do is maintain a bunch of heat bottles. Bullshit. You know, we lost a lot of guys drowning in vehicles in Iraq. Now again, granted, it's not going to save everybody, but if it saves one person, isn't that worth it? My eyes, it is.
Well, if you've ever, I'll tell you what, if you've ever gone through trying to save somebody that's slowly drowning.
Oh.
If you've ever gone through that, and I've been a part of two of them. One was, we got up armored Humvees, and not everybody was used to driving them. Not everybody was used to, if you were near a canal, because they were so much heavier, it was inadvisable to get near the edge because the ground would give way because of the weight. And when Mike and I were there in 2006, it was right when we were doing our initial relief in place. I don't know if Mike was there yet, but, there was, just a patrol going down. There was just this, waterway called the Tartar Canal, and Marines were driving up armored Humvees, getting used to them, and got near the edge of the road. The edge of the road crumbled towards the water, and the vehicle rolled in the water, and it was shallow water, and the vehicle started to fill up. But now it's on its roof, and the doors are in probably 3 or 4 inches of mud, and they can't get out, and they're screaming, right? And it's filling up, and you can't, and they're trying it. Guys are trying to open doors and they drowned. And then the other one was inside of a tank that did not get ground guided across an engineer bridge. And you know, the driver was a PFC. He got near the edge. He panicked because I guess he lost. You know, again, it's supposed to be ground guided. You know, it's Marine 101, but people make mistakes. It went off the bridge upside down into a canal. And with bottles, I'm not sure that we could have saved them even if they had bottles because of the weight of the tank. But, I mean, at least they would have had a chance. And they drowned.
Give someone a chance. The one with the Humvee in the water, I was there for that. You know, that one was because we weren't prepared. You know, so after that we learned, okay, we attach tow ropes and pull that thing out as fast as possible.
Right.
Someone's stripping the gear, jumping in with the water, grabbing their tow rope, linking up to the vehicle, and then yanking that thing out. You know, but again, give someone the opportunity. And again, it goes back to, if it can save one life, it's worth it. It's absolutely worth it. It doesn't have to save 10 to be economical and feasible and realistic. Just one.
Right.
Just one kid.
And as Mike said, whatever problems, as he said, you know, would you say roller skating to the moon or canoeing to the moon?
Canoeing to the moon.
Yeah.
That's what I used to tell people. The only thing that's impossible to do is to get in a canoe and go to the moon. You can't do it. You just can't do it. Everything else is possible. You just got to give it a try.
Let me read you another email. Let's see. Hold on. Hey, Mac, I heard your comments earlier about the Osprey. I found them somewhat interesting, as I'm not as familiar with that platform. I'd be curious to hear what the gunner has to say about it. Appreciate the program. I want to echo thoughts and prayers go out to the three families this week that will bury their sons and never get to say goodbye to them again. It's heartbreaking, just like what happened in Mississippi. Enjoy the program. Semper Fidelis. Mike, I made the program that the Marine Corps does not have a medium. I made the point earlier, the Marine Corps does not have a medium lift capability. The Osprey is too much of a China doll. It's a one-trick pony over the horizon. If it had to go into an LZ quick and get out quick, it simply cannot do that. The transitioning takes too much time, as opposed to a Black Hawk that simply flares, drops down, picks whatever up 10 feet, nose down, and then they go the other way. We don't have that capability. The 46 used to take us everywhere. And, I thought, you know, of all the platforms I've ever flown in, it was my favorite. It was reliable, take you in and out. Those guys could fly the shit out of those things, snap of the earth and whatnot. We don't have that capability anymore in the Marine Corps. The Osprey over the horizon, special ops, I got it. It's awesome. Into a benign environment, awesome. But when it's transitioning to get into an LZ and out, it's slower than shit. Your thoughts about that? That was my point. I'm not sure if you agree or not.
Mac, I actually wrote a point paper a long time ago on the whole triad, and then it was the M777, lightweight 155, the Osprey, and then the LCAC that gave us this huge capability. And then the EFV was going in and out, and then it died. You know, the expeditionary fighting vehicle, and then the AAAV, whatever the hell they called it later on. Died on the vine. But I wrote a point paper one time of why are we spending the money and the resources and the brain power to come up with a tilt rotor platform when we can buy the Blackhawks. You know, the Blackhawk, and I forget what it was, but it talked about the whole power rate, weight ratio, the range, the lift capability. It can fly in, you know, in every, it's an all weather platform. It's got some serious legs. It can go forever. You know, and the new ones, I don't know if they're on the K's or the M's or whatever they're on now, MH60s. You can get them in different variants. You can get them in gunships. You can get them in drop tanks on the damn thing. I mean, there was, and you could still carry like freaking 12, 16 dudes in the thing. It was just stupid. And there's a bajillion parts in the program. Everybody's flying them. So I mean, it just became this ludicrous of why in the hell were we going after something at the time that seemed cool, looked cool, and I get it for the mission, special mission stuff and the long range capabilities, you know, that's pretty neat. But you're right, we were going to lack a medium lift capability, a combat airframe that can get us in and out. And, you know, when I first saw the Osprey in combat, I was appalled that we had to offset the landing zone by like 2 kilometers away to a flat piece of ground, and then one at a time go in because the brownout, this thing when it was coming into the desert, would create such a brownout that, you know, you could only have one land at a time. It was just asinine. So now the guys are on the ground, and what are they being supported by? A couple of Cobras, you know, that can only be on station for 15, 20 minutes? You know, that was the whole thing of why didn't we go with the Blackhawk? You know, shit, the Blackhawk then could loiter, provide support. It could then do CASVAC, medevac platform right there if needed. You know, it blew my mind. And it's got in-flight capable refueling too. You can put a probe on the damn thing.
Right.
Fly it across the damn Atlantic Ocean. So, I mean, it really blew my mind why we did that.
And they're kind of expensive too, in case you don't know.
The Osprey?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, the special ops community loves them, right? But again, like Mike said, you get marginally better performance in terms of straight flight speed of the Osprey. But the Blackhawk, that thing refuels in air. You could do the same thing. You might have to refuel it more often than you would but the cost of what you give up was not, in my opinion, was not worth what the Osprey brought to the table. It is not all that. If you have to get in and out quick, you can't send the China doll, because anytime somebody sneezes at one, right, people get their panties in a bunch.
Yeah.
Right? An Osprey? Like, oh my God, no. It's like, oh what? It's not part of the fighting force? What? Why not the Osprey?
General Amos gave me a hard time. When he was coming up, we knew each other, and we'd worked with each other before. We were good friends. And he came out to do a talk at 1st Marine Regiment, and I was a regimental gunner there. And I had one time, you know, told, I had said something about to him if we could get, you know, if you didn't take delivery of one Osprey, we could solve all of the infantry problems, equipment, fielding problems in one day. All the money saved from one Osprey would solve the entire Marine Corps infantry's problems on fielding and equipment. All the stuff that we were looking, the new helmets, the new body armor, all the new IAR, individual automatic rifles, more better scopes, suppressors, all of that. When you rolled all that money together, it was one Osprey. And so it came up when he was talking to 1st Marine Regiment, and he was out there, and he was talking to the whole regiment, and I was back there, and he goes, "Where's Gunner Musselman?" And I'm like, "Right here, sir." And he goes, "Okay." Gunner came up with the idea of if I don't field one Osprey, I can solve the infantry problem. You know, and all the guys were like, yeah. You know, so he went on to that, and just kind of making fun of me. But, I mean, that was the problem with the damn thing. It was so damn expensive.
Right.
And, yeah, they're cool. They're believe me, they have a chick-digit factor of, you know, of 10. But, you know, there was a lot of problems that came with it.
A lot of things we're still trying to find out now. The day in, day out lifting that our medium lift stuff does, I would tell you it is the biggest component of our tactical mobility. And the way it affected us in Afghanistan was we would get into these gunfights. Our patrols were essentially a lot of times bait to get shot at. And then once they get shot at, then we kind of close on with aviation, maybe another adjacent unit to go kill these guys. You know, and once you make them dead and you start thinning the herd, then everybody doesn't sign up that quick anymore. They don't want to go anymore. In fact, while we were there, when the winter came and the next spring showed up, they did not have a lot of guys like wanting to make the second deployment. And so, cause they knew they were going to get dead. But what, one of the things that we thought would be great, wouldn't it be great to have a Black Hawk shut down in a firm base, so when this contact gets made, you could insert a squad behind these guys, cut them off, and either kill or capture them.
Yeah.
That would present a problem that they don't have a solution for. Because what they did, they shoot at you, right? They take off their man dress and make it a different color. They ditch the weapon and they try to wash their hands. So when we sprayed the gunpowder residue test on their hands, that it wouldn't test. And then the first mosque they found, they would walk into. That's how the game got played. And we were limited because we didn't have a medium lift that wasn't a China doll, because you would never shut down an Osprey in a firm base, God forbid. We do it with a 46 in a heartbeat. We do it with a Black Hawk in a heartbeat. And so, I mean, it's frustrating that, you know, we don't have that capability. I've got another email for you. Hey, Mac, I just tuned in. Sorry if you guys have already covered this, but I wanted to get Mike's opinion about something relative to the crash of the Osprey. What would the guys inside know on their way to the water if it was controlled or uncontrolled either way? How does that get communicated, or would they simply know by virtue of looking around and watching what the fuck is going on? Mike, is there any way that's communicated to the guys in the back?
No. I mean, like I said, I went down, I landed on a 46 as we were coming in to land. So I was expecting to land. The only thing I noticed differently at that point was the engine sounded different. And then before my brain could register, like, that's not normal, it was impact. Boom. So you have no time to think. And in this case, you know, it's an uncontrolled into the water. So these guys they just loaded up. They just went in forward flight or to transition in forward flight. So their mind is actions on the objective. They're thinking, okay, when I get there, I can't wait to get the hell out of this thing. And next thing you know, depending on what the altitude was, and from the talk of it, I don't think they were that high. this thing went down and went into the water before really anybody could get there. The first time I think that they realized that they were crashing was when they crashed. Right. Whereas a controlled, it's going to be announced. You know you're going to go down. The crew chief's going to tell you, either brace for impact or, everybody prepare, and it's going to be communicated. There's going to be, you're going to have time to think. You're going to look. You're going to make sure, okay, there's my exit. I'm holding my right hand onto the bar. I'm going to release the point with my left hand. I'm not going to let go. As soon as we impact, I'm the fourth guy that's going to go out this right side window. Okay, got it. Da, 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 da. You're going through this in your mind. You're pushing your gear away. You're preparing yourself mentally, physically for what is about to happen. Uncontrolled, most of the time, the first time you know that you're going to go down is when you're down. So there is no time to think. That's all, hopefully, again, training kicks in because, when things happen, you want to react. So, again, it helps when you get more repetitions under your belt, touches on the ball, because when it happens, you want that mechanical response to take over. And if you've done it once or twice, man, you're going to be searching in your brain for what's going to happen because there's a lot of things going through your mind.
Well, no, I mean, it just goes to our previous little discussion about, in that event, the fact that 23 guys got out.
Miracle.
That is. That's a straight up, as all the shit Mike said, boom, you impact, shit flies everywhere. Somebody could get knocked out. Somebody could get hung up. Somebody can't get out of their gear. All the different things that can happen. Somebody inflates their vest inside the aircraft because they panic. All that shit that goes on is just incredible. It's just incredible.
Yeah, if your exit becomes foul, right. I mean, there's a lot of things that can happen. Yeah.
Right. All right.
And again, this is a God's miracle that these guys, 23 guys, made it out. And it's sad that there are hundreds of people now mourning the loss of these three young Marines that were because you think of the lives that these Marines, they were sons, they were husbands, they were fathers, they were everything. Brothers, nephews, cousins, and now people, and I hope we learn from this so we don't make this mistake again. Now, will another Osprey crash? Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. Will loss of life result from it? I hope not. I hope that, the next time that we do this, all 26 guys get out.
But out of that investigation ought to come a finding that, X number of these guys went to the Hilo Dunker one time or no times, and the Marine Corps needs to fix that. Or else.
Yeah, we deployed guys without going to the Hilo Dunker.
Right.
We did. We had to. And we had to write a waiver stating that we couldn't get these guys through. Because, again, General Nicholson out in 3MES, he wants full-up rounds, and I don't blame him. He wants units that are ready to get there and do real-world missions. But I'm telling you, it's difficult, especially when you have 6 or 7 main efforts going on at one time.
Yeah, everything's important. But
everything's important.
But, there are life and death. To me, it's like teaching your kid how to swim.
The most important thing is, no matter what your focus is, your main effort is, the most important thing is preserving life. Preserving the life of those young Marines, giving them every opportunity, if they're ever met with that type of that obstacle, that we did everything in our power to give them every tool to actually overcome that and to survive. That's our job. I hope that this finding doesn't find any faults, that we sent guys over there, that none of these guys, that it would just be horrible.
Another email. Hey, Mac, I heard you say the Commandant stopped to see them, that he was out at Guadalcanal. I know him. Certainly not a surprise that he would want to go do that. Mike, your thoughts?
Any one of them would have done it.
Neller's a good man, but Mike's right.
Neller is the guy you want in your squad. He's the epitome of a Marine. He's a rough and tumble guy. He knows his audience. He knows how to speak to people, and he truly, truly loves Marines. So, yeah, I know he's taking this one personal. And same with Green, Sergeant Major Green. You know, that's another stellar, absolute individual that, you know, is the one mess Sergeant Major. This hits close to home for him. And he was an advocate of this stuff, so. You know, and hopefully these guys, something change comes of this.
Somebody said, hey, Mac, do you know who these guys were? There's one of the pilots, First Lieutenant Benjamin Cross, was 26 years old from Oxford, Maine. Corporal Nathaniel Ordway, 21, of Sedgwick, Kansas, and PFC Ruben Velasco, 19, of Los Angeles. Lieutenant Cross and Corporal Ordway were part of the air crew, and PFC Velasco was part of the battery that supports 3-5. So those three Marines and there's quick search. You'll see all of them. Ordway, I don't know if he went to West Point or VMI, but he's got the.
He went to Citadel or VMI or something.
Yeah.
He was
either the pilot or the co-pilot. I'm not sure which one. I would be surprised if a first lieutenant was a pilot, but it happens of that aircraft. But anyway, no, Mike. First of all, on behalf of thanks for explaining all of this stuff. To me, it's one of the great things that All Marine Radio does, and people come to expect it, that when something happens relative to Marine stuff, that they can come on here and listen and hear not speculation, but people with experience talk in a measured way about the challenges that we face, how we try to meet them, where we're lacking, and what we as the Marine Corps as an organization, I say we, can do to be better. And just on a personal note, my son sent me a note last night saying that, hey Dad, the Commandant and the Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps were here. They were both awesome. Sergeant Major made us laugh a little bit, but one of the things that was evident was how much he and the Commandant cared about us, cared about the Marines we lost, but it was just good to have those guys swing through there. Thank God they were at Guadalcanal, because it meant a lot to all of us. He's a first lieutenant, first deployment he's ever made, right? And this stuff, I mean, this is welcome to Men's Town, motherfucker, right? And you can read all the books you want, but it's different when you live it, right? When you flew on that Hilo yesterday, you flew on that Osprey yesterday, and you know these guys, I mean, that shit lands with a thud, and then to have the Commandant swing through is an example of the kind of leadership that, you know, in the Marine Corps we love, and that means a lot to all of us. It just sucks, and I'll tell you what, I mean, just. I'd never experienced this from this end of it, being a dad, you know, so having guys like Mike to talk to, our other buddies to talk to, I'm lucky because I have that. I feel bad for parents that aren't connected like that, and you have to sit there and wait to find out, you know, is it us or is it not us? And so Saturday was a long day, And,
yeah.
You and Rudy and everybody who chimed in and either offered some advice or this is how this will work, helps a lot. And, you know, the other thing was I could feel just in what they were sending, I mean, they'd met Patrick, right? You know, my buddy Luke and Chris Bronzy, they wrote him letters to get an OCS. It's not like this is not a family event for my extended family. And so, but it was, I think for all of us, it was a little bit different in that we're here now. We're normally forward. And, you know, normally when we lose guys, it's not the events like this. It's somebody kills them, and what we focus on is finding who did it and killing them. And we can take it out. The role of dependent, where you sit here and wait, is a foreign kind of a role for us. And
right.
And it's a below average experience too. It sucks, but having buddies that help and are supportive is awesome. One more email, Mike. Hey Mac, before you leave, just to, again, to echo other people, thank you for all the explanations. It certainly helps us. When I saw that again, I thought, wow, that's awesome. I didn't realize what a miracle it was, though. After listening to Mike describe it and the discussion, wow, I will keep those families in my prayers, but I'm also thankful it could have been a hell of a lot more families that were going through this. Kudos to those Marines in that aircraft who obviously did what they were supposed to do, not only inside the bird, but once they surfaced outside the water and took care of each other. Let's hope that they recover the remains of those three Marines so those families can have closure. Amen to that.
Right.
Amen to that. All right, man. First of all,
sure.
Thanks.
All right.
Thanks for coming on doing this.
Yep, I'll talk to you tomorrow.
All right, there you have it. Michael Musselman. I'm blessed in my life that I have great buddies. You get to hear all of them, or most all of them. The guys that are still on active duty, they don't come on for good reason. But they're a part of my family. And but I have awesome friends. And Mike was one of the first phone calls I got. And again, they know the drill. I know you haven't heard anything, just wanted to say what's up. Because he knows they're in River City. Hey, you know the probability, it's not that, you know the probability he's okay. I said, I know. Hang in there, you know, we'll see if what we can find out. And so, no, it's awesome. Another email. Mac, you just mentioned remains. How does that work? You're unsure if they're inside or out of the aircraft. Hopefully they'll be inside the aircraft so the families will have bodies. But the truth is sometimes you never recover them. So, so again, the wreckage has been, you know, identified. The Australian Navy is working on bringing it to the surface. Hopefully, when that happens, you know, those families can get the remains of their sons, and they can appropriately mourn their loss, and can put an end to it. But that's how that happens. So, well, again, keep those families in our prayers and hope that happens. So, anyway, that'll do it on a Wednesday that feels like Monday. This program repeats itself momentarily. Have a great day. Grant Newsham's going to join us tomorrow. We finally solved the calm issue. The calm issue, not the calm issue. We'll never solve the calm issue. The calm issue we solved, and he'll join us tomorrow. We'll talk North Korea. So, have a great afternoon. This program repeats itself. If you missed it, don't touch that dial. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.